Good evening. It's been a long time since I've been here. I'm really happy to be back. The last time I was supposed to come, I came to grief in some kind of way, one of the many ways that I seem to be charging through old age. So I'm really especially happy to have actually made it here tonight. It's a treat. And a treat to see how beautifully it's kept here. And the garden looks gorgeous, just wonderful. Has such a very nice feeling. Plain, but elegant at the same time. I think Coben would like it like this. I drove him here over the mountain for Wednesday nights many times. So it seems like coming home in a way. One of the many homes that we were lucky enough to have with Coben. So I've been thinking a lot about holding on. Especially in terms of the eighth precept of no hoarding materials or teachings. Hoarding is such a cool word. We don't use it very often. And it has a sort of kind of ugly feel to it. If we hoard our candy as a child, no, don't tell anybody, but I'm keeping these little candies in my pocket and I won't. I'll have them all for myself. All of the precepts, of course, are arising from our own self-knowledge. From our deep study of how it is to be this astonishing creature we call human being. And when we think in terms of how much we want to keep, how much we want to save, how much we want to hold on, we begin to see that it's about survival. How can we keep going unless we hold on to things? But actually, it doesn't say not to hold on to things. It says no hoarding. So it's not so much an instruction on what to do as what a kind of encouragement not to. Not to be too heavy, not to be too intent and intense about our own survival. The marvelous thing is that we here have come to such a pass that we're able to practice. We have enough to eat. We have shelter. Often we don't have as much as we think we should have or that we would like to have. And all those should-haves and like-to-haves is where hoarding comes in. It steps over the okayness into another condition of the mind. The mind that starts to want more. I tell the story I'm going to tell now many times just because it taught me this lesson the very first time. And that's when I went to Koban with a big question for Doksan. And I was very anxious and very needy. And I was eager to sit down with him face to face. And when I got to where his Doksan room was, in somebody else's house, he said, "Oh, let's go to the park." And I was very disappointed. I didn't want to go to the park. I wanted to sit down with my big question. And I had no choice. So we went to the park and sat down on a bench. And Koban brought out a bag. And in the bag were a bunch of cookies that he'd brought along. And he offered me a cookie. And I took it. And as I took it, a great big dog came up and started nuzzling and poking at the bag. And I started pushing the dog away and saying, "Go away, dog, go away. These cookies are not for you." And Koban looked at the dog and reached into the bag and took two cookies and gave them to the dog. And the dog went off happy. And I sat there absolutely floored. Totally forgot my question. Everything was over. And I realized how greedy I'd been. How very much I did not want to share those cookies with the dog. And how easy it is to fall into that kind of mind. "Go away, dog. We're sitting here doing important things. We have big questions to answer." When the truth is, we're just right here. And of course, everybody loves cookies, and everybody should have one. And the truth is, we don't own the cookies. We don't really, as Bodhidharma pointed out, we really don't own anything. We have a temporary responsibility for a lot of things. Temporarily, we have to take care of where we live and our own body and mind, keeping ourselves strong and healthy in order to practice. The essence of our ability to stay alive is so that we can have the strength and ability to do our work here on earth. Being here for others, because we're free to be this way. With great good fortune, we've come to a place where we can do for others. If we were really starving, if we were being bombed, if we were in one of the many terrible conditions that people are going through in other parts of the world, we wouldn't be able to practice like this. And so this business of not hoarding or holding on or being attached to our goodies is about our practice itself. What we're able to do because we're able to practice. And of course, we do own things. or think we do. We might have a mortgage or a rental agreement. We certainly have a body. And it's easy to think that this is my body. But truth is, who is my? Who is this who is claiming this piece of electromechanical meat, I sometimes say, this amazing critter on two legs walking through the grass? Who owns this? Who's running this show? So as we wake up in our life every day, we wake up to the mystery of what this is. And pick up again our responsibilities. The abilities that we're able to respond to with because of our condition, our very, very fortunate condition. As we live. And of course we're grumpy and complaining and we want more. I often think we trade off greed, anger, or hatred and delusion, and that some of us specialize in one or another of those, and I certainly specialize on the greed side. So this is a big subject for me, and I know for many of us, how much we want, including the teachings. How wonderful that the teachings are available to us. And yet, if we keep our practice in a pocket, or keep it to ourselves, or make it a secret. I know for the first year or so that I practiced at Haiku Zendo, I never mentioned it to anybody. I was really afraid to say anything. My husband thought it was a cult. And so I thought if he thought it was a cult, what would everybody else think? So it was very much a hiding out for a long time. And yet when it became possible to talk about it, to simply mention it as a life, I was very surprised how interested people were and how meaningful it was, even though the people I spoke with, mostly the parents of my children's friends, weren't interested in the same way I was. But it was a wonderful thing to be able to at least mention that there was a practice and a way. Not as a proselytizing way. I had a born-again brother who is full of proselytizing, so I knew what that was, and we can't do that. But we can share from our heart, not in a special way, but in our own way, speaking up. And being the loving kindness that we discover in our sitting. Being this mysterious, one that is also too, also other. That's why this is so important. Bodhidharma said, self-nature is mysteriously profound in the midst of all-pervading truth, not to raise hoarding, attaching to any form is called no hoarding precept. Self-nature is mysteriously profound. So our attachment to the self is the sort of bottom line of our practice. We have to take care of this, but we can't own it or claim it. And now I'm finding a whole new aspect of that just because I'm having a lot of birthdays. And every time I have one, I'm startled to see that this thing goes on. It just keeps going on. And that it isn't anything to do with me. It's the whole thing unrolling, opening up, ripening beyond our intention even, but within our deepest wish as our life carries us. And of course we don't know. And so it's well not to be hoarding or being attached to things because they get taken away in any case. And when I come here and think of in my life what has gone, I have to think first of my teacher, whose picture is at the back of the altar, and of Catherine, your teacher, whose picture is on the back of the altar, Suzuki Roshi. Think of all the ones that we knew and loved and who are gone. And all the ones we never knew who are rising up through the folds of existence and coming to take Catherine's place and Coben's place. We're all standing on the shoulders of our teachers. So we let it go over and over. There's nothing to keep and everything to share. So that's the generosity part. That mind of not hoarding is the mind of generosity. It's a little... Sometimes people take generosity to a farthest edge. And my teacher did sometimes. He was extremely generous. I was with him at the airport one time and somebody came up and asked him for money. And Coben just reached into his pocket and took everything out and gave it to him. And then he didn't have any money, so it got a little complicated. But On the other hand, he would sometimes admire something at somebody's house and take off with it. So it can be extreme, but sometimes the extremes are very refreshing. There's a practice that Pema Chodron does that a friend of mine experienced when she went to a practice period up in Nova Scotia, in which they were invited to bring their most precious thing, something they really, really loved that they could put on the altar for the whole length of the practice period. And so she brought something her grandmother gave her, a brooch or something very, very wonderful and precious. And everybody had something and they put it on the altar. And when the practice period was over, they all expected to get them back. They didn't. She kept them. So, she didn't have to say anything. She just did it. And I just had a curious experience, having been taking a balance class. It's kind of a funny thing to do, but for me it was a very important thing to learn how to balance properly. And when it was over the other day, the teacher said to me, "Oh, you're doing really well. And I've given you everything. You just have to practice now every day." And I said, "Yes, I would." And she looked at me and she said, "But you know, you're not going to get any better." I thought, "Oh, yeah, I'm not going to get any better. Isn't that amazing?" And I let it go. What I didn't even know I was holding on to. So we're lucky that way. We meet our challenges whether we are ready for them or not. And we let go when we have to, because the truth is so startling and clear that we have to accept it. So that's what I brought to talk about. And just wanting to encourage us all, including myself, to especially feel gratitude for our great good fortune that we're able to be like this and to stay awake to it. Don't forget how it is with us so that we're able to open it up. So there's lots of time for comments and questions. Kathy?
You know, you're sharing about Coven and generosity. I just wanted to share something that maybe some of the newer people here don't know. The people who've been here a while have, and I'm sure you do. But this Zen Center was given to us by COVID's students.
Yes.
And I just think it's really important to say that at this time.
Yeah.
You know, I know that COVID's community got the place for a pretty small amount from a generous donor who was ready to move on in his life and stay in Japan, and so gave it to the community for like $10,000 or something like that. But then when we started practicing here with Catherine, just a handful of us, she had just started. And Chuck Atkinson, who was the president of the board, basically said to us, you want this Zen Center? And we went, okay. And that's how we got it.
Yeah.
They gave it to us.
Yeah.
And of course, since then, people have donated generously and we've expanded it. But I never want to forget that the whole existence of this place, as we know it and appreciate it, the rarity of it, was a gift. So I just wanted to speak.
Thank you for that. Thank you very much. That was Jim Goodhue, who owned the house. Owned this and the house. And this was a Chinese laundry when he bought it. and it was not in terribly good shape either. But it was a good enough sendo. It was fine. Yes, it was Jim Goodhue's gift. And then Chuck and Carolyn and Ellen and the little sangha down here that didn't have a teacher anymore because Coben left. He left us all, actually. Just ran away to New Mexico and left us holding the bag. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah.
So you answered. The aging process that I'm feeling, and I've used that term before. The trouble with getting older is things don't get better. Some things don't get better. I cry some, you know, when I feel that. When I see something on my body that I don't like, you know. I wonder, where do you feel it? Or you can think about it and, you know, and encourage yourself with the precepts and the generosity. But where does it get you, so to speak?
Well, in several different ways. One is around pain, and I've got some. And when I had surgery many years ago now, I woke up in the hospital in a lot of pain, and I found myself holding myself and rocking and saying, "Oh, poor thing. You poor thing, I'm so sorry." And I felt so much better that I realized all the rest of my life that I could do that at any time. And do, so if my knee gives out, I console it. And it's not so skitsy that I'm split. It's skitsy. No, it's not a split exactly, but it's a relationship that we have with our body. We can get mad, you know, the stupid knee. There it is again. It's such a bother. But actually, you know, it's a knee. So that's mostly what I do.
See in here.
Yes.
You mentioned about how you accepted your balance teacher saying you're not going to get any better. How do you look at the other side where pretty much we all know we're going to get worse? Worse things are going to happen to us.
Yes. Well, if we call it worse, we can just call it process. But it's a process that we tend to think of it as a downhill slope because it means that we're less and less able to do the things that we love to do, less and less able to fulfill this human existence that we've been working to fulfill our whole life in one way or another. And when you get to the point where you can't walk up and down stairs very well or at all, or you come down with cancer or anything else that's alarming and definitely downhill, you have to face it. It's the truth of it, including the end, which we think is the end, because we don't know. Kind of seems like it. We certainly have not seen anything to show us what the rest of it is, if there's a rest of it. So it's exciting in a way. It's very interesting. You know, and there are many different ways of approaching it. And it's important to not take it too personally. It's not a personal thing.
Are there things you, as you see death on the horizon, mm-hmm. are there things that you feel like you really want to do in this life that haven't been, that feel not complete? And if so, how would you work with that?
I ask myself that question sometimes. But I think more and more that if tomorrow I'm done, that's fine. I've done a lot. It's not much in relative terms. It's a little pip, but it's as much as I feel I could do. And I have no regrets, really. If I live another 15 years, that would be remarkable. But if I go tomorrow, that would be remarkable, too. So I hope I'm around when it happens. I want to be there. Yes, well, I think that's our practice, really. That's how we do our practice, is allowing ourselves not to know, or not to attach ourselves to an idea that we can't let go of with ease.
It's just that, you know, because, I mean, appreciate it, because you're reciting the precepts, and, like, to some extent, I can see how we hold to the values that we were either taught or that we adopt as new, mm-hmm. as the ones that we keep as a guidepost, and they're also taught that way,
yes.
to be guideposts, no matter what's happening. And at the same time, you know, especially with the precept that you were just reciting, it's actually one that throws you totally into the unknown, it totally invites you to be in the unknown, it takes a double, I can see the double function. Of on one point, like, you know, don't, you know, don't, mm-hmm. worry, just stay with the don't, as a, okay, I know, I don't.
Yes.
But then too late. And you do, you be generous, and you don't know what's going to happen after. You know, I mean, let's say you like to have a story about how it's going to look like if you're generous. And we have a story
yes.
about how it's going to look like if you're
harbor.
And at the same time, they're inviting us to not know what's happening.
Well, we find out everything after the fact, including what we say. We don't know what words are coming out of our mouth until we've said them. You know, just the words that you've just expressed, you didn't know what you were going to say until you said them. And I now am saying these words, and I'm not planning them. They're just coming out of me. Where are they coming from? So we do hold on to the things that we've been conditioned to believe. But if we hold on too tightly, we get in trouble. So that's the meaning and of Buddha's teaching about where our suffering is coming from. It isn't the ideas themselves, it's the clinging to them that brings us into a lot of suffering. This can't be happening to me. Well, it is happening to me, so then what? So then it's time to let go and be informed by the new situation and learn this new thing. But sometimes we resist very hard and say, no, I don't want it to be like this. And so
that seems to be what you're saying, the remedy to fear, too. Like,
yes.
It's like you just move. You're over here.
Yes.
You don't know and you're afraid.
Well, and just be curious. Just think like a scientist rather than I don't know what the opposite of that is, but be really scientifically curious. What is this now? What is the truth of this thing right now that's happening? And it's always something very interesting and sometimes remarkable. And if we don't shut ourselves away from it, then it's great. Patrick.
Andy, how do you negotiate the mind of non-hoarding? Maybe negotiation is, maybe you just don't negotiate, but you know, with examples like Colvin emptying his wallet, or you know, wasn't one of Buddha's lives about he fed himself to a tiger or how he lied? You know, I'm going to come up short. and yet, I like to practice non-hoarding.
Well, isn't that true of all the precepts? I mean, we can't possibly fulfill them in the way that we would like. We kill with every breath. We lie with every word we speak. So we can't hold ourselves to some impossible standard. And in fact, that's what I would call, maybe Nagarjuna would call, too much. You know, that there's a middle place in there that makes sense. We don't get off on the deep end either way. I think Colvin often went off in the deep end and got in a lot of trouble because of it.
I just locked my bicycle outside, and I said, "You know, what am I holding on to?" So underlying that question, I think.
Yes, I understand. Yes?
I have to respond to that for my friend Patrick. It's an old Sufi saying, believe in God, but tether your camel. I kind of see that one.
Especially here.
Oh, yeah, we've had some stuff.
Yes, where people like to steal things. Not Sangha members.
Well, I understand, because I moved to San Jose about a year ago, and I have never locked my house in all the years that I've lived in any house or my car. And so I was living in San Jose like that, and somebody got into my car. So it didn't do a whole lot of harm, but it woke me up to the fact that I was living in San Jose now, and it's you have to tether the camel. I like that. Yeah, we have to use a very careful, discriminating mind to make our way through this complicated life and the complications of this world that we find ourselves in. It's not simple. Yes.
Can you speak to the choices you would make if you were offered life-sustaining treatment, or whether you would accept it or refuse it?
Under what conditions?
Well, if you had a life-threatening illness.
Well, I had cancer one time, and I called up my teacher and told him. Some of you know this story. And he burst into tears and hung up. And then he called me back. And he said, you know, we all have to die. And I felt so much better. I cannot tell you how much better I felt. The truth is almost always food for us. It's our water, it's our actual condition is the truth. And we don't like it sometimes. I didn't like cancer, I was scared. And then he took my fear away. Of course, we all have to die, and maybe now is the time. But that was 30 years ago, so we don't know.
Chose treatment, which
I did.
Successful.
I did, yes. Yeah, I wasn't nearly done then. I had a lot more to do. Yeah.
How did you know that you had more to do? Or how did you decide?
I've often thought it was my greed. Koji was built on my greed, among other things. Very powerful desire. And it wasn't done. Yes. Well, it's a matter of accepting how paradoxical every moment is and negotiating the paradox as we go through our life. Instead of expecting it to make a lot of sense, it often doesn't make sense, or it makes two kinds of senses and we can't make them work together very well, and we can either butt our heads against it and try to make a story out of it, or we can accept that it's a paradox. That makes sense.
Just it makes practice, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, is 7:30 the witching hour?
About.
Okay. Is there anything else? Yes.
Just apropos of Jane's question, which I think is a great one, because I ask myself that a lot. But around this practice, and then for me, always the dilemma of practicing music. Mm. And I think about, well, I'm always practicing. There is some idea of a time where I could play without thinking, and it wouldn't be practice anymore. You know, mm-hmm. Maybe I shouldn't call this practice. But then, what's in the meantime? I'm practicing, but can't I also just play where I'm at also as well, you know, and let that expression be whatever it is? So I'm working, I'm practicing, I'm doing, you know, I'm working on technique, but then there's times where I can let that go and forget about it and just play. But there's always, so there's this, there are all the elements that, yes, we're practicing for some time when maybe we wouldn't have to practice. I don't know if that's true, or we could just be spontaneous and whole that way. But then I'm sure, even from what you've been saying, in the midst of that practice, we're here, we're present, we're spontaneous in our lives anyway. You can't get away from it.
Yes. And in terms of an art, if you practice the art a lot, then you become freed from you doing it. But you can't say that you then start doing it in a different way. It's that it starts doing it through you. So again, it's not a personal thing at all. And as often as it's personal, the farther you are from ability, from expression. Well, it's a joy to be here. It's a joy to see you all. I wish us all well.
Thank you.
Beings are numberless. I've